Okay, we'll start. So this is the last lecture of the three lectures on attention. And we're going to talk about a bit, particularly about integrating attention. Okay, so we've talked before in the previous lectures about the roles that attention play, and in particular, selecting what part of what you attend to for further processing. So there's also other functions that attention has, and in particular one of them is more the supervisory or executive function. Now this particularly relates to memory and other instances, and if you remember I briefly said about the whole issue of multitasking and how you decide how to divide your attention between different tasks. So I'm not going to say a lot about that here, but in general, as said before, look at the readings. If you want to follow up things in more depth, then see which readings relate to that. What I'm particularly going to talk about today, though, is about binding perceptual features of objects and how we perceive, how we attend to different features and end up perceiving a particular object rather than just a mixture of features, how these are bound in order then to move to memory. Okay, so one function of attention is how we get, in terms of our perception of objects in the environment, how we get a coherent perception. And if you remember, we said before about when we talk about the visual system, that the modularity of the brain. And one of the issues is that you may have different areas that specialize, but when you perceive an object, you're bringing together knowledge in those different areas. So we don't tend to, when we look at something, just see all the separate perceptual qualities. We tend to see objects as an integrated thing that may have a number of different features, but not seen as just all those features separately. So in the introductory lecture, if you remember, Henry showed you the McGurk effect very briefly. May not or may not mean anything to you now, it was a few weeks ago. So I'm just gonna show you a bit of video in relation to that. And it's actually just an extract taken from a Horizon program and talks about a particular phenomena that demonstrates how we don't just perceive separate features, but by integrating them, it may actually change the perception of what we're actually either seeing or, in this case, hearing. So we'll see if we can get this to work. Okay, what I may need to do is go out of this. So this is a YouTube video.
At any one moment, we are being bombarded by sensory information. Our brains do a remarkable job of making sense of it all. It seems easy enough to separate the sounds we hear from the sights we see. But there is one illusion that reveals this isn't always the case.
Ba, ba, ba.
Have a look at this. What do you hear?
Ba, ba, ba. Ba, ba, ba.
But look what happens when we change the picture.
Ba, ba, ba. Ba, ba, ba. Ba.
And yet, the sound hasn't changed. In every clip, you are only ever hearing bar with a B.
Bar. What a lot of people hear in that point, bar. You're watching the mouth.
It's an illusion known as the McGurk effect.
That's the mouth shape.
Take another look.
Bar.
Concentrate first on the right of the screen.
Bar.
Now to the left of the screen.
Bar.
The illusion occurs because what you are seeing clashes with what you are hearing.
In the illusion, what we see overrides what we hear. So the mouth movements we see as we look at a face can actually influence what we believe we're hearing. If we close our eyes, we actually hear the sound as it is. If we open our eyes, we actually see how the mouth movements can influence what we're hearing.
Ba, ba, ba.
It's a bizarre effect. Remember, the only sound you're hearing is ba with a B.
Ba, 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 ba.
What's remarkable about this illusion is even knowing how it's done doesn't seem to make a difference.
The effect works no matter how much you know about the effect. I've been studying the McGurk effect for 25 years now, and I've been the face in the stimuli. I've seen stimuli thousands and thousands of times, but the effect still works on me. I can't help it. The speech brain just takes in that information and doesn't care about what outside knowledge you bring to bear. Ba, ba.
The McGurk effect shows us that what we hear may not always be the truth. But it also helps us to understand what happens when our senses conflict.
When the brain has the conflicting information, it tries to make sense of that conflict. And depending on what type of modality is providing more, I guess, salient information, that information might override or at least combine with the other information.
So we can't always trust what we hear, because sometimes our sense of vision takes over, enabling us to maintain a coherent view of the world.
It may be that from the looks on some of your faces, you didn't get the effect strongly there. But there are other cases where, if you think about it, where if you're watching a film and, for example, they've edited it for content, so they may remove things like certain words and substitute another word instead, particularly if it's, you know, below the 9 o'clock deadline. So you actually may see the person saying one thing, what you actually hear is something else being substituted for a particular word. And in those cases as well, you know, it becomes evident you attend to that, but there is the issue of, you know, how you deal with that. Most of the time what you're doing is actually integrating those things and you don't notice. So if you look at something like an object, whilst that may have a number of different features, what you tend to see is it's an object. I could ask you after, say, you know, what are the features? Okay, it's white, it's got a straight edge, it's got a curved edge. You could describe it that way. But what you don't, whilst one level of perception, you may be looking at and identifying features at the lower level. Remember, we talked about how we may have different feature detectors, for example, for different orientations of lines. At the higher level, and when it comes to attending to the object, you tend to just see the unified object. So what we talk about here is the binding problem. So where we have different features, what happens is our perception leads us for those things to be bound to come up with a single object. And this also, if we look at it in more detail, as I said, we're only going to look at it briefly here in overview, but again, if you want to read more about it, find out more, you know, look at the readings for the course. What this tells us something about is how the lower level neural signals are combined in ways that when they go higher up the processing, we don't just see that as the lower level signals, the lower level features. So we'll come on and look at memory in a few weeks' time. And when we look at memory, we'll look at this a bit more. And particularly as this being important when we're looking at how we move what we see in the world, what we extract from the world, into long-term memory, so we have continuous access to it and how it relates to that. And also, we'll all be talking then about a particular model of memory, in this case, the Badly Hitch model, and how this relates also to the processes that go on when we're moving from what we learn from moving around, from seeing objects in the environment, to actually, you know, processing them and keeping them in memory. So binding, it helps us to understand better, you know, how we detect and recognize objects under different conditions. So the challenge here is trying to represent a complete and coherent object. And then maybe, if we have an object, there may be many, many different ways we could segment it, but the challenge here is to combine those. We can have objects that appear in different combinations. They can be overlapping, for example, but we don't tend to see them. If you have two objects, or if you have objects occluding the others, so one object in front of the other, you still tend to perceive them as separate objects. You know, your processing allows you to do that. You don't end up with all those things mixed up. We can do it at different points in the visual field. So, you know, wherever things appear, we still may then perceive them as separate objects. And we recognize, we're very good at recognizing objects and patterns in our environment. Now, some of the work on this that has been done more on the cognitive side has also then informed research on the machine vision side. And we've talked about this before, about how we can take sometimes techniques and things that we learn from looking at the human system in order then to look at how we might automate this if we're trying to model it within computer systems. So a lot of work particularly has been done on machine vision in this, and looking at how you might have specific feature detectors, but then how the knowledge from those gets combined in particular ways to recognize objects. So then you have models of objects that may start with detecting the low-level features, but what you end up eventually is an object model, and it could be a body model, it could be an object you're manipulating, it could be a person, a face. But we've still got a long way to go on this. So one particular theory that attempts to address this is feature integration theory, and it talks about how the human system, the visual system, solves this problem, how it goes about combining the features. And this is particular work by Treisman, and then again, as I said, there's references to that if you want to read up a bit more. Now, the level at which this theory is, it's not at the physiological level, it's at the higher behavioral level. And again, remember, we're talking about cognitive processing here. We also need to think about what level we're talking at it about it at. So is it we're talking about at the lower level, the neuroscience, the neurophysiology, or are we talking at much higher levels of processing, in this case, talking about the behavioral level? What happens in this theory is attention is really important. So attention is an important component to this theory, and the theory suggests that where you have this binding, that is, the bringing together of the different features that allow you to see something as an integrated object, they talk about it as happening in two stages. The first stage they talk about as the pre-attentive stage. So you may be identifying the features, but you're making maps of those features. But then what we have is the focused attention stage, where what happens is these features get bound together as objects. So there's two stages in this. So it's fairly, this is just a fairly simple diagrammatic representation that. So if you look at the Goldstein vision text, that talks about this at a fairly simplified level. But if you want to get more details, you know, then obviously go to the original report there. So at the pre-attentive stage, what we have is features of the object are separated into feature maps. So you might have objects that are, say, you know, you've got a blue square or a red circle. You know, if you're looking at it in terms of fairly simple shapes, which tend to be the things people have used when they're doing sort of studies of this stuff. So you might have it done by color, by line orientation. And then a master location map's hypothesized to store item locations without necessarily noting what the other features are. So you've got two sorts of information, where things are and what features they have. At the focused attention stage, so the second stage of this, what happens is binding is triggered and it's hypothesized to be retrieving the connections there between the individual feature maps. So as we said before, if we have various lower level feature detectors, then at some point we're going to have to integrate those in order then to come up with more object models. So this is what the binding process is doing. So a subset of features may be perceived in a particular location, and what you may be doing then is temporarily ignoring those features in other locations in order then to bind the particular object, the features that relate to a particular object in a particular location. So if the object is green and it's square and you've got other green objects and other square objects in other locations, what you're going to be focusing on there, what your attention will focus on, is the location of the object you're looking at and the green and the squareness of that, if that makes sense. In some of the work that was done by Treisman, what they found is that if you show people a set of objects, then you can look and see which sorts of features they first notice or which objects they first notice and how long this takes. So what they were doing were looking at how you can get binding even when you have very quite short stimuli of different types. So they might show the objects at different locations, but one of the problems may be if you show them for too short a time, you effectively don't get the whole process completed. So all the stages aren't completed. And what happens is you may end up incorrectly attributing different features, the wrong features to the wrong objects. Okay, so the process of doing this takes a certain amount of time, and if you interrupt it by showing the particular objects for a shorter period of time, you may end up with a mixture of the features and the objects. So I'm going to give you an example of this in a minute. What they were doing then in this, when they were trying to investigate this further, they were looking at giving very brief displays of objects, and they were also having a masking slide in between. And remember, we talked the other day about the general design of a lot of these studies is that you may have some blank slide or some other slide in between in order to, that actually effectively does interrupt the processing. What the people were asked to do in that particular case, the participants, was they were asked to report the black numbers. So you're trying to get people to focus on particular objects there and then the shapes at each location. And what we found, what they found is that quite often they would actually report things like seeing a small green triangle. Do you remember if there was a green triangle in that display there? Okay, there's a green object and there's a triangle, but there's not a green triangle. And what happened was by getting participants to focus on the numbers, they often then would report also, if asked what else they'd seen, that they had also seen a green triangle. And the reason this is interesting and useful is that you may find when your attention is divided, the same sort of things happen. So this happens. This was just doing it within the lab, but it also can happen outside of that. So what I'm going to do is just quickly show you an example. What I want you to do is write down all the letters you remember seeing and their colours. Okay, so you ready for this? To wait till you're actually looking, because otherwise you won't see it at all. Okay. So see if you can even write down a couple of those. I'll do it once more. Okay, now I'm going to show you what I showed you for longer and see if you managed to get any of those right. Or see also if you found there were any that you gave the wrong colour to. Okay, how many of you had at least one where you gave the wrong colour to? Yeah, okay. We didn't give you very long to do it, that was the point, that you did still see the number, you did still see the colour, but you didn't manage to integrate those correctly to do the binding for the specific object. You were actually crossing the features across objects. So these sorts of studies are done to explore that sort of process and to understand, you know, how your processing, in particular relation to attention, works. Obviously, if you have longer, then you have longer to process it and you don't get that happening. So these are referred to as, this is an illusory conjunction where you think you see a conjunction of colours, of features that are actually not there. When you're looking at vision, if remember we talked about how you have brief looks towards things, you have saccades, your eye moves very briefly, but most of the time it is moving. So you have the different fixation locations that you ask the person to look at. So for example, in relation to the black letters, you have people fixating in those areas, and that's where you're going to get the deeper processing. But it's also going to depend on what time you allow them to look. So actually what you need is a minimum of 200 milliseconds to fixate on an area and to actually more deeply process that. So in the experiment that these people were doing, that was actually a crucial timing. You can get an overview of the scene in that time, but you can't get the detail. You can't attend to all the items. Now, if you took the strategy when I was doing that of just focusing on one letter and just making sure you got that one right, then yes, you can get that one, but you won't be getting the others. If you try and do all the letters, then again, obviously your attention is split and you're not going to manage the processing as well. So we get these illusionary correlations between the features. Now, this not only applies to vision, but it can also happen in the auditory system, and that's sort of like the example I showed you, the McGurk effect there. That's primarily a visual, an auditory example of that. Well, when you're combining the auditory and visual information, then you're getting things conflicting. So in other systems as well, there may be, you can apply this feature integration theory. So some researchers have done this in terms of listening tasks, of giving different conjunctions of sound with different pitch, with different instruments. And what happened is you get the same sort of effect. If we don't hear them for very long, they may attribute the wrong pitch to the wrong instrument, or they may get these features mixed up. And you get similar sorts of effects as you have in the visual tasks. Other work found that in terms of the sound location, if you vary that as well, then features that are closer together or overlapping in time are more likely to be bound into single auditory events. So if you hear things in conjunction with each other, then you're more likely to bind them together and combine them. Now, this may be quite a short lecture. We may just decide to leave it here today. I'll talk a bit more about the synchrony hypothesis, but we may just end up earlier today. Okay. So if we want to look at the binding problem, another level we can look at it is the neurobiological level. So the question there we'll be asking, how do you get, what relationships do you have between the neurons, what they're doing and how they're responding to features in the scene? And the synchrony hypothesis looks at this. It's also called the temporal correlation hypothesis. So what that proposes is the patterns that you have of firing in different parts of the brain, and these may correspond to the different features of the object. So remember we were saying about this more specialized responses to different line orientations, to curves, these things. they may be synchronized to each other if they're firing on the same object. So what you may be happening there is the actual firing for that object, but on different features, may occur at the same time, which may then help you see those things, those features that are all being attached to that particular object. And again, that's just a very high level description, but if you want to read more about that, then follow up the references on that. So it doesn't just mean, though, that this synchrony could just be in terms of timing, but it could be synchronized in terms of the different patterns as well. And the synchrony, the fact that these things are synchronized, is what may lead to the binding and indicate the features belong to a specific object. It isn't the case that's just in relation to attention, but attention may help increase the chances of this neural synchrony. Okay, so in the readings for this, it's giving you a few more things if you want to follow up any of those specific topics there. But I know it's only 5:30, but I'm going to stop there for today, okay? So next week we're going to look at, we're going to start looking more at experimental design and how we might go about designing studies. And then we'll be talking in concurrent weeks on things like cognitive modeling. And next week's tutorial and lab will focus more on following up some of the stuff we've done in attention this week. Okay?
I'm writing about Lithuanian language because I'm Lithuanian.
Right.
And Lithuanian language only has two affixes.
Right.
To form the negative.
Okay.
Of words. And you asked to write only about nouns and verbs.
Right.
Can I also include adjectives?
I think if you extend it to include other things, then just explain why you're doing that.
Okay.
And just, you know, if you justify what you're doing and explain why, that should be...
I mean, it has to be 3 to 5 pages.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if I would
be able to say enough. I mean, the other thing is, you know, if you can even just compare it with English, that would be good, although that's obviously more work.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll try to.
Okay.